Mr. Merchant Reel 3, you were saying that most of the men were killed in twos.
Yes.
That's because they were paired up.
That's right. Well, the two RE officers had a bunker next door to my little slit trench, and this 2-inch mortar pound, Japanese mortar bomb came down and killed them both. So, of course, better take them down and bury them straight away.
Did you have padres with burial services there?
Yeah, yeah. An RC padre, yeah. Oh, yeah, we had padres, yeah. We put them in sort of canvas sheets and carried them down. And the Bengal Sabres and Manners dug the graves, and we put them in a little service, and that was that. Buried a lot there. A lot of people buried there.
Were many of the mules casualties in the fighting?
Yes, yes, they were, yes. But one interesting thing, we had a pony, gave birth to a foal in White City. And this chap Madison, he was in charge of this pony. Because we had a sergeant who was called Sergeant Lee. He was a gypsy who came from Brenepin Forest Way, and he couldn't read or write, but he was marvellous, and they made him from a fusilier up to a sergeant, because he, as soon as the mules came, they came from, I think, Missouri, United States, bred up, especially strong mules, you see, and he right away had a sort of gift for that. He had his hand in days, so they made him a sergeant, but he couldn't read or write. And he came in, and when they knew this pony was going to fall down, and helped it give him birth. And him and John sort of looked after this pony, and they called it Minnie, because there was one of our 3-inch mortar posts was there, and they called the mule Minnie. And it was later flown out. They got a glider. The Yanks brought a glider in one night with some Bofors ammunition and stuff, a Bofors gun stripped down, because they'd flown in 4 Bofors guns, actually. When the Japs came over one day in a big area, they shot down 5 of them. They never came after that, because they were marvelous little guns, you know, 40 rounds a minute, each gun. These chaps were chaps who volunteered from the Battle of the War of London. They were both for gunners, and then they volunteered and came out. Anyway, they put this pony, this little foal, into this glider, and they took up, I say, 2 poles with a wire through, and the Dakota came with a big hook, and picked it up and towed the glider back to Lallaghat with a foal in, and it went back, was flown back to England, and became the mascot of the Lancashire Fusiliers. And they took it out to Egypt in the Suez Crisis, and it died out there when it was about 8. And the 4 hooves are up in the museum at Rochdale, made into ashtrays in the museum. There was quite an article on BBC Two last year about it. It was called about different army regiments and the queer sort of things they did. Because you've seen the Lancashire Fusiliers on Minden Day, which is the 1st of August, to celebrate the Battle of Minden in the Peninsular Wars. We used to have a big, what we call a ram sammy, a big booze up, an enormous feast in which the officers used to wait on all the men and do no work. And the beauty squared side and blow jangers, punishment stations outside the CO's office. And it was all one mad do, you see. Chaps used to walk around with lanterns in the middle of the day, drunk as lords. And the youngest officer would stand up and eat a pink and yellow rose in front of all the battalions. They do that every 1st of August, which is Minden Day. There were about 5 or 6 regiments, Black Watch, and all that in Minden Day, you see. And
coming back to White City.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the patrols that you went out on?
Yes. We went out one day with Captain Butler and Corporal Shenton to look for a 6-inch mortar. We went through a sort of zigzag in the wire, which is, as soon as we got it, people were around wiring it all up, you see. The Japs could never find it in the dark, but it went zigzag through the one wire, was about 100 foot thick there. We got out and we went down onto the woods, approaching what we call the Maya Dam, which is the open space of the paddy fields towards Morlu there. And we found in the bit of jungle some weapon pits dug, with the Japanese that come in and wait up and have their evening before they come to attack the block. And there was tins of fish and all, so we pinched those and planted some of these bullets in the bottom of the... do you know, these pits were dug and the walls were smoother. You never saw anything like as smooth as that. They had people that used to, same as we did, I suppose, used to come up and dig the trenches for the Japanese soldiers, and they would get in. The walls were smooth, perfectly upright. Little recesses back where they could go and sit, and we found tins of fish and Japanese cigarettes and photographs of the wives and children, things like that. But we didn't take any of that, because if they caught you, they'd kill you. There was no... I've got to tell you that before we went in, we were told if ever we were in danger of being captured by the Japanese, we were to put a grenade to our chest and pull the, and kill ourselves, because the Japanese would torture us, you see, because there was no prisoners. Outside of Molu, the other column, 50 column, had 7 or 8, I don't know, injured men, and they left them in a thicket while they went on a patrol. When they came back, they were all dead, smashed to pieces. So there was no mercy, and there was no prisoners ever taken on either side. You killed everybody twice over to make sure they were dead. It was pretty ruthless, really. Well, we went in on this patrol, we walked around. We went out about 9 o'clock, we had breakfast, went in and filled our water bottles up, we went out, and we got onto the edge of the paddy fields, and we found these little slit trenches and bunkers that the Japanese had built, and we pinched all the fish that was there, but we didn't have anything else in case we were caught. Then we went out through the jungle, we had this machine, this thud of this 6-inch mortar. It would fire, you could hear it, and you could count 30 by the time it landed in the block. 30 seconds it took to land, about 4.5 miles. But we never found it, because the time we'd got there and crept through the jungle, the Japs were all around you. See, it was frightening, absolutely terrifying, really. And we never spoke a word, we just crept about all the day, and we never found it. We got within, I suppose, about a mile of it. But 4.5 miles of jungle was a long way, you see. And we wanted to get back to White City before it got dark, not to be trapped outside, because we might have been killed by our own people getting back. We got to within about 200 yards, and we couldn't find the wire in the jungle to get us back into the block. And we saw some chaps running across, so we opened fire on them. And we fired at each other for about 10 minutes. And then someone said to some of our chaps, so it turned out to be a chap called Blades, who was my best pal before we went in. He was a corporal. But we always said before we went in, we would never take promotion, because once you get promoted, in the length of a few years, corporals couldn't go out with privates, and privates couldn't go out with land. It was terrible, really. But you see, when you got in there, you got made up to a corporal. You see, he was what they call war substantive, which meant that he was a peacetime soldier. When he came out, he'd be a full corporal, you see. But he gave me his mother's name and address. I gave him my wife's address in case anything happened. But the same night he was killed. But I never wrote, John, you don't do it I never wrote to his mother. His brother was killed up on the northwest frontier with the Devons. And he was killed that night in White City. But we were finding each other for 10 minutes. We didn't know who they were. You couldn't see in the dark. We just got into the block. And we were just brewing up a cup of tea before stand to, because at stand to, night and morning, stew to for half an hour in the trench. Everybody, whatever they're doing, just stew to and into the bunkers and trenches for the attack. And this shells kept coming on. There was an enormous lot of shells bombarded the plaster of the block, frightened us all to death, because there was nowhere. We just got in a bunker and prayed. And they gradually crept up. We were rather lucky. The shells kept landing in front. And then they went over and landed in the middle where the HQ was, and the mules and all that, and the first aid dressing place. And about 9 o'clock, I suppose about 2,000 on the attack, the wire, shouting and screaming, chucking themselves on the wire, they threw themselves on the wire, the others could run up over them and try and get in. They got in further down, they broke through, and they got in on an old peel behind us. But in the morning, we all went up there, turfed them out, killed them. They'd got in, about 15 had got through, but what they did, we got through, and when it came down, instead of running out, they hid away in our bunkers, you see.
Did you take part in that turfing out?
Yes.
How did you do it?
Well, we just ran up and got everybody out and ran and threw grenades in all the weapon pits and bunkers. Killed them. They were all in riding away. Told us then we had to carry them all down and bury them, you see. But around the wire, without kidding, there were dead bodies everywhere. And they were crawling with maggots, because a fly would lay an egg on a body, on the blood, and they would hatch out in a couple of hours. And then maggots, you could see the maggots dropping off. And the animals used to come up at night in the dark and eat the bodies. And the crows would come down and peck at them.
What kind of animals?
You could hear them in the north, I should think, jackals and stuff like that. But of course, there was all sorts of animals in the Burma jungle. But you wouldn't get big stuff like tigers and leopards there. But things like jackals, and that kind of thing would come up and eat the dead bodies, you see.
So the smell must have been appalling.
Ghastly, ghastly. And the trench, the latrine trench, was about 80 yards long, and it was just a pool to sit on. And it was one, when you looked in, it was about 14 foot deep, it was just one white with maggots. There was one rather funny thing, which we thought was fun. One of our chaps, the Lancashire Fusilier chaps, came back with a flamethrower, because when the Japs come out at night, you should fire this flamethrower and set them alight, you see. And there's a mixture, you know, this thing on the back with a mixture of paraffin and petrol. And when the Japs came up on the wire, he used to fire this thing and set the jungle alight. Well, he went up and emptied this thing in the toilet and sat on the thing, you see, for a bloody crap, and chucked the match, and it all went up and blew him up, you see, and, set, and he had to be flown back to England. All his backside all burnt, and his back, boy, we thought it was a huge joke at the time, but it wasn't. He never really got over it. He was flown back to England, to London, for, I think the skin grafts was just coming into being there for skin grafts. But we turfed the Japs out that night, and the following night, we were partially relieved by the 3rd West African Brigade, which flew into Aberdeen and marched over. But on the way over from Aberdeen to White City, they got shot up, and when they got around us, they were in a hell of a state. They were ambushed by the Japanese, but they came over and took over our trenches then. By this time, then I was ill with malaria, and they gave me 20, although we were still taking Mabry, they gave me 20 quinine tablets, which I should have taken 2 a day. But, you know, I kept taking them. I took about 8 the first day, you see, and I got delirious. And in the night, I was singing and shouting like I was drunk, you see. And so I think they thought I had either quartan malaria or cerebral malaria, because I was really desperately ill then. I had dysentery, and I was riddled with malaria. And this would be in the beginning of May. And they came along to me and said to me, they said, you're going to be flown to Aberdeen and flown out, because we were going off to Mogong and you're not fit to march. Well, I didn't know where I was coming to go. I didn't know, you know, what was to what. I was in a terrible state. I didn't really understand what they were all saying. But I know that they took me out to the airstrip into a slit trench, and this light plane came down. But every time we went to get in this light plane, the Japanese would shell the strip, you see. And would carry me back and put me in this bloody trench again. But eventually, there's an L1, this would take 3, there was an, I think he was an RE sergeant, he stepped onto one of our mines and blown his legs off, and he was in the line down with both legs off, he was dying. And there was a West African with his part of his hand off, and me. So in the end, they left us in the plane. And the American pilot, he was in the bunker. Well, all of a sudden, he came out, ran in, jumped in, and we took off. Flew to Aberdeen, about 30 miles away. We no sooner got there and got in the plane and overcame a heap of 9 bombers and bombed the place. And you know, they had a siren fitted up in Aberdeen, the same as in England, you know, woo, that thing. And they said, run, run up into the woods. We all ran into the woods. I couldn't run, so they left me on the bloody deck.
Took me
on the ground. I just stayed there while the bombs came crashing down. I couldn't get up. Then they put us into tents, and I was first inside. He said, you'd be first out, Bo. He said, we'll put you in first. I was first on the right, and they came in that night and took it from the left. Still the first I was on that. And they flew us out to Sillett Airstrip, all weather strip, with you know, this metal planking. And it was absolutely, the weather was terrible. Storm, rain, monsoon rains. And I was put in a little tent in the morning, the tent gone. I was laying out in the water. All my stuff had gone. Almost everything I had except my wallet, which was in my shirt with my wife's photograph, my son's photograph.
You mean just washed away?
Washed away, yeah. In 4 foot of water. Yeah, they started digging the monsoon drains, but they hadn't got enough labour, and they weren't all dug, you see. They were dug, but they weren't dug far enough away, and they filled up with water, you see. All my stuff washed away. So I was carried then into the hospital at Sillett and saw various doctors there. And then I was there for about a week, taking liquid quinine and some other kind of drugs, sulfur drugs or something, I forget which. And they put me in with other chaps in the truck and drove us to Shillong, which is the summer capital of Assam, up through a place called Cherrapunji, which was the wettest spot in the world.
How much did you weigh?
Just under 8 stone. Yeah.
And did you get proper treatment at Shillong?
Well, but hit or miss, you see, there were thousands of casualties coming in from the chin. This was just a place special. There was chinders coming in all the time, you see. But We got food and rest, which was the main thing, and sleep. You see, we slept at night. We had food for the first time. We had proper food because we went for weeks in there sometimes with nothing. Sometimes we went into a little village and got a bit of rice, but mostly we just had K rations. And you see, very often, a week's K rations would have to last a fortnight. You see, it'd drop your 5 days' supply in there for the last 10 days. Yeah, I was just under 8 stone then. I was up there at convalescent for till August. That was fitting.
With the other Chindit casualties.
That's right, yeah. What I did do once, they took me down to a place called Dinjan, and I got into Dakota and flew to Chunming in China with supplies, and my job was, if the Dakota was attacked by air, was to jettison the goods, the stuff. This was stuff being taken to Chiang Kai-shek. Flying over the hump, they called it. And I stayed there the following day and the night and came back with one of the empty planes the next day. And then every time my name came up again, one chap who loved it, he used to take my place. He was mad. He did 40-odd trips to Chongqing. He flew to a place called Dinjan on all-weather strip. The Dakotas were taken off every 2 or 3 minutes. It was amazing, flying to China, to keep the Japanese occupied because they had about 27... or 50-odd divisions in the front they were going to bring into the Pacific and to Burma, you see. So the Yanks' idea was to keep them occupied in China and tie them down. We used to fly over with, you know, a ton of stuff in the Dakota.
After Shillong, what physical condition were you in? Had you fully recovered?
No, not really, no. But we went back to, I rejoined, I got a warrant from the army and went to a place called Deera Dun in Punjab. Went through, stopped in Calcutta for a couple of days there and had a look around and then went back because we could do really, the Chinese, we were a pretty special sort of people. We could go anywhere on leaving India, we were the only people. So I got back in there and...
How would people recognise you as Chindits?
No one knew what we were. We had these little badges. I've still got them. Well, I'll show you later. I've still got my original Chindit badge, which you pinned on your arm. Went to Karachi on leave, four of us, at 1,500 rupees, because we had no pay, you see. Because all we did was booze. We got drunk and fighting. There, went to an RAF dance one night. We never sent, so we just paraded and charged in, you see. Woke up in prison in the morning. Yeah, woke up in prison in Karachi, woke up in prison in Delhi, used to get drinking rum, you see. Used to play hard and work hard and play hard in the Chindits. Used to drink a lot out there. Well, what else is there to do?
How were you treated in the prisons?
All right, fine. Fried eggs and bacon. Shook hands and dropped a room before we left from the RAF place. We're all friends. They didn't quite understand us, and we didn't understand them. But we just wanted to get into the dance. If they said you can go in, we wouldn't have gone in, because they said we couldn't go in. So we wanted to go in, you see. Because it was just for RAF personnel. But we got in, but we were finished up in the clink. We got a few bruises around the head and that, but we didn't bother. We started a cycle and cycled out to the beach in Karachi. No one on the beach, just thousands of big stinging jellyfish. 120 in the shade. But it was a hectic life, but it was a great life, really. You had a sort of comradeship, you know, that you'd never experience in ordinary life. But we're all a bit wild, really. It was a hard life in the Chindits, but then we were mad, really, I think.
And you were declared unfit for further service in the Chindits?
That's right, yes, yeah. Unfit. Too much malaria. I had malaria 9 times, dysentery. You see, they thought I had cerebral malaria, you see, because I was so delirious, but... I never thought at the time, I was probably due to taking too many quinine tablets at once, you see. But I was shouting, delirious, screaming the place down. They had to get me out because it was not much good in the jungle, screaming about it if you got one blow. But I didn't really know anything about it until I got out. I was told mostly what happened afterwards, you see. And then I've been a good shot. They want to be armour sergeant, or I could go in the military police if I passed. So I said, oh, I think I'll go in the military police. So I went away to the military police and went on a course there and... I think the third or fourth day on the course, we were playing football in the afternoon, or the evening then, rather, and I fell down, a fellow dislocated my shoulder, my right shoulder, so I couldn't take any notes. But at the end of the day, I came second in the exam, so I went straight in the military police. So I liked that, really. It was quite a nice, cushy little life. Well, cushy because you get to go in the pubs and chuck out all the drunks. But I travelled all over India in a military place. It's quite interesting.
One thing you were telling me about earlier was about the effect of ABCA, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, and their lectures on the political attitude of the soldiers.
Yes.
Can you repeat to me what you were telling me earlier?
Well, we didn't realise at the time, but we were being brainwashed that there was sort of the Churchill was a warmonger and it caused the war, and that the Labour Party were going to come in and they were going to fund this health scheme and they were going to do all this and all that, and it sounded marvellous, you see. And that the war needn't have happened and all that. They were sort of giving us propaganda, what I call socialist propaganda, but we didn't realise at the time. But afterwards, when I got a bit more way wise in the way, I realised it was socialist propaganda. So we all voted Labour, and that's how they got in. I honestly believe that's how they got in. Of course, India was full of the Communist Party. Every little village had a little communist cell, you see. They all thought, I could see through, I knew the communism was no good, especially when I got that book about the Gulag.
Archipelago.
Yeah, you see, I read that book and I knew all the time and all about the big famine, and Stalin had killed off millions of, up to 30 million people. That's communism. It's only a question of time before it all fell apart, but it came suddenly, didn't it?
Yes. Where did you have these ABCA lectures?
Well, they started off when I was down at a place called Bangalore. I was a Bangalore and police unit. We used to go in and keep, have to be out of the lectures. See, there was no trouble. A couple of us on duty, you know, with our red caps and 50 coats of blank on your shoes, or do your tie on them. And I then thought they were a bit biased at the church. I knew the church hadn't caused the war. He was just one of the things that he saved us during the war. But they were sort of saying, in my opinion, that Churchill was a warmonger and that it all could have been solved peacefully. But I mean, anybody with one iota of brains could see that nothing's going to stop it. He was a megalomaniac, wasn't he?
So you only went to the ABCA talks after you came out of the church?
That's right, after.
Not before?
No, after. No, they weren't. They only started in 1945. See, when I joined the military police, I went up to Rawalpindi in the Airborne, 3rd Airborne Brigade. And of course, when I was walking down the street, and I used to get chaps drunk, you see, and they used to say, oh, it's all right up here, there's a couple of military police, no chaps up here, sort of thing. So I used to get hold of them, see, if they did that. And have a look and say, how long have you been out of your soldier? Have a look at your paper. I say, been out 6 weeks, you see, from England. Never seen an angry child. One day, there was a big riot at a place called Flashman's Restaurant. And the King's Liverpool tore the place apart. I mean, we didn't dare go in there. There was about 50, and they smashed everything up. They smashed the bottles, they smashed the mirrors, they smashed the chairs. And I had to go up and give evidence, you see. And this chap said to me, this adjutant of the King's, he said, excuse me, Corporal, I'd like to point out one thing. He said, these chaps have been in behind the Japanese lines in Burma, he said. He said, they haven't been stuck here in the military police. So I said, well, excuse me, sir. I said, I went in the gliders on day one, with the King's Liverpool. So I said, with the Lancashire Fusiliers. I said, here's my little paper. Go from the eyes and read where the Burma Star. I said, in actual fact, I said, the casualties suffered by the Queens, I said, were outnumbered 8-1 by the Lancashire Fusiliers. I said, because the Lancashire Fusiliers with the 3rd highest, the 77th Brigade suffered more casualties than all the rest of the chindis put together, did all most of the fighting. And I said, don't give me any bullshit, I said, about the Kings, I know all about the Kings. I said, I was in the legs of Fusiliers, I said. And we took part in the Battle of Morgan, which the Kings missed. I said, they were mostly cut up in the gladders, I said, but they didn't have the fighting we did. They weren't in the block at White City. So we shut right up. Yeah. But we got that sort of, but I didn't worry about that. I knew that I'd been behind the lines, and these young soldiers, I wouldn't have it. So I used to pinch them and stick them in the neck, you see. But if they were sorry, corporal sort of thing, just had a few drinks, I'd say, off you go then.
Where was that they caused the trouble? Whereabouts was it?
Rawalpindi. Yeah.
And what was the name of the place?
Flashman's, it was called. We see.
Flashman's Bar.
Flashman's Bar and Restaurant. You see, in the military police, we used to go in there overnight, and they would give a free meal to the military police. You could have sort of a meal, whatever you like, within a certain range, but you couldn't have any drinks. You go on down, you had to buy them, you see. Well, then one day, it's rather funny, the restaurant owner decided he would cut down and not give the police a meal, so we went down, we had to pay for it, you see. So this night, this enormous shouting was going, he came running up the road to me, and he said, quick, Sam, big trouble. I said, or I'll get my book and say, what's your name, sort of thing. I've been in his restaurant for about 3 months, eating his food every night. What's your name? So he said, well, I was taking all this time, this is Christmas, I'm going to go in there. So when I'd finished taking all, they'd gone then, but then I went down and arrested the last few, you see. I'd got through on the phone to headquarters, got down there, about some of our blokes with big pick handles, you see. And we fixed up the ones who was left out. I mean, they were mad. But I understood how they felt, you see, because I'd done the same thing. Perhaps not as very stupid as bashing on a plane. I never did that because we just got drunk and forced our way into a place we shouldn't have done. Although we were beating up the military police up in Delhi once, and the Yanks came in with these big clubs and beat us up.
The snowdrops.
Yeah, put us right inside, they did. But we went back the following day and sat down with the police while I was in the LFCs, had a few drinks with them. I left my wallet there.
Coming back to the ABCA talks,
yes.
What kind of people were giving the talks?
Well, they were army people, the semi-army people. They came out from England to sort of tell you about the end of the war, get you sort of used to civilian life again. You say that kind of thing.
What type of things would they tell you about how better it would be after the war?
That's right.
What kind of things were supposed to be better?
Well, about the health scheme and everybody's going to get somewhere to live and you're all going to have to get a job and all this crap, as I called it. I didn't take too much notice, but of course, you see all these things sort of subconsciously at the back of your mind. Yes.
But what rank would they have, these people?
Well, they were like a padre in the army. They weren't they were given perhaps a rank, but it wasn't a real rank. Like, you see, we had a padre who lives out at the other side of Credin. Now, he was a captain, but he was a captain. He was in a padre. He was a talk aids captain, but he was a talk. He didn't really have a... He's a very nice fellow called Ben Aberyn, used to be at Tynmouth. Well, you see, he was a padre in the Chindits. But you see, he didn't come in with us. He stayed at Sillett, that I got there. And he was really in the talk age. But you see, these people, that is sort of, they were called captains, but they weren't. If you know, they'd been this, like a war correspondent sort of thing. We had war correspondents with us most of the time.
Were these lectures well attended? Or did people have to go? Or were they free to go or not?
You were advised to go. You know, it's like in the army. You don't have to go, but if you don't go, we'll fix you up, sort of thing. So people went. Some were interested, some went out of boredom, I suppose. But I realised that they were, you know, politically, a lot of chaps didn't know, but I could see they were saying it was going to be a marvellous new world. And we're all going to get free medical. So I said, I remember saying at the time, well, nothing's for nothing. I said, who's going to pay? It's all going to come. Everybody pays so much a week into the health scheme. Nobody'd be sick, and in the end, they said that people wouldn't be sick because they'd all have good health. I said, people will always be sick because there's always people who dodge a bloody column. I said, there'd be people who would be sick all the time. Nothing's free, is it?
You said that there was a Communist Party presence in all the villages and so on.
Ah, there was in every village there was a communist cell, yes. But they didn't, I mean, they were Indians, but they thought it was a new Brit. The communists in India, the Indians were very simple peasant people. They lead terrible lives. I mean, probably they might be better off under communism because they had such a low standard of living.
But did the Indian communists attempt to contact you?
No, they didn't, no. Because most of them couldn't speak English, you see. They lived in the... But every little village right in the wild. We went to some villages in India that had never seen white people, never ever seen white people before. When we were training around the Yorkshire area. Because Jhansi was a big area in the mutiny. There was a Rani of Jhansi, you see, if you know anything about it, remember, which you obviously do.